The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
My name is Signe Wilkinson, and I am a big fan of this program, and I hope that all of you who are not already members of the Free Library Foundation will be by the end of the evening, because it supports the best lecture series in Philadelphia. We've had tons of writers come to town, so many writers that it's gotten boring. All they do is use words. Well, tonight we have a very special program because we have someone who has done an entire book, as you know, without any. He's a genius. The last time I did an introduction for somebody who had something to do with cartooning, it was for everybody's favorite pornographer, Larry Flint, who contributed to the cartooning world by being sued by Jerry Falwell for a cartoon that he had in his magazine. He took it to the Supreme Court, and thanks to Larry Flint, we have the best freedom of speech of pretty much anyone in the United States. Tonight's guest has contributed to cartooning in much different ways, as, again, you know. He's used his pen to expand what cartooning itself is all about. He has taken the long view, both in his topics, like Palestine and Gaza, but also, quite literally, with his format, which in his current book, The Great War, folds out to be 24 feet long. He can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it's the longest editorial cartoon ever drawn. And I use the word editorial cartoon despite the cartoonist's pretense of objectivity. According to the subtitle, this appears to be a straightforward depiction of July 1st, 1916, the first day of the Battle of the Somme. The cartoonist makes us view the scene from above, coolly removed from the action that seems at first to unfold neutrally below. Yet, without words, he draws us, no pun intended, into the horror of a battle that took 21,000 lives. In a brief introduction, Sacco writes, "All I could do was show what happened between the general and the grave and hope that even after 100 years, the bad taste has not been washed from our mouths." Like the greatest cartoons about the insanity of war, he brilliantly makes this point without firing a single word. So, friends, please welcome tonight's guest, Joe Sacco.
Thank you.
Thanks. Did Signe explain sort of what the book is? Does everybody know what the book is? That it opens up like this, and it's 24-foot long drawing? Which is kind of cool. It's not like normal books, really. anyway, so let's start and talk about your interest, where your interest in World War I came from, sort of, originally.
All right. Can you all hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay. I grew up in Australia. That's where I spent my childhood. And in Australia, the landings at Gallipoli in 1915 really figure very heavily in the Australian sense of itself, Australia's sense of itself. They feel that's where they came of age, in a way. So it's a big part of the Australian national psyche. And when I was a boy in school, on Anzac Day, the day they commemorate the landings at Gallipoli, school would stop, and they would broadcast over the loudspeakers in the classrooms stories of Australian servicemen in the war, in wars, but particularly World War One.
Right. And Anzac Day, because it's Australian and New Zealand.
New Zealand Army Corps.
As part of the British Empire's forces in World War One.
Right. Well, I mean, the British were able to draw from many elements of the empire, including the Indians, for example, and other places. So many people saw action in France in the war. But as a boy, I was kind of fascinated by World War One. I had some books on it. And, you know, that sort of standard boyhood interest in things like poison gas masks, just that those things sort of, as a boy, I mean, they're intriguing somehow, biplanes. But even when I was reading about it, I was quite impressed by this notion of trench warfare. And I was very impressed by some of the words like over the top or no man's land, because as a boy, when you parse those words, no man's land, you know, you take it literally, and to me, it meant literally, no man could live in no man's land, and so there was a weird fascination that's sort of a boyhood thing, but also informed by sort of a horrible realization of what had happened, and the interest never left me. I have shelves of books about the First World War, and in the 80s, when I was in my late 20s or so, I actually visited the Somme battlefield.
Oh, you did?
I went there, and I went to Flanders also. And I spent like 5 days hitching around and just reading tombstones, because they have some beautiful cemeteries. Some are quite large, and some are small. And, you know, it's such a fascinating place, because in this one cemetery for Australians, very small. They have a guest book in a sort of a brick case. And I took out the guest book, and they have the name of the person who tends to the graves for the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. And he had his number there, so I called him up. And he came out. He was so excited that someone was interested that he drove out. And then he drove me all around to these places, you know, telling me what happened where. And then what was the most interesting thing, he drove me to a farm, a confluence of like three farms, where shells that had been gathered in the last couple of weeks had been piled up, shells from the First World War. There were about 70 of them. Piled
unexploded.
He said some were live and some weren't.
Uh-huh.
But they were in a pile, and they were waiting to be collected by the municipal authorities there, as I think they still do to this day. That's very impressive that they're still finding that sort of thing.
Right. Right, but so that lay of the land, literally, for you that you then explored in this book, you were there on that land.
Yeah, I walked over it. Yeah.
Right,
and so this interest has been with me for a very, very long time.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, it's sort of a coincidence that I did a book, because many years ago I was living with a guy in New York City named Matt Weiland, and he was in the publishing industry. And one drunken night when we were playing darts, he said, wouldn't it be great, you know, one of those conversations that starts out that way, wouldn't it be great if you drew a panorama of the Western Front?
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, okay, let's just have another drink. And 15 years later, he becomes an editor at Norton, W.W. Norton, and he calls me up, I think, the day he started work, and he said, do you remember that idea? Do you want to do it?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I hadn't thought about doing that particular book, but he suggested it. And then I thought, you know what? I've been thinking about World War One for so long. It's time not to be a sort of a historical voyeur. It's time to actually do something.
Right. And in those years in the interim, you never really felt compelled to go there.
Actually, there were times I thought about doing a book about World War One. Like, I was obsessed with the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand, and I bought the transcript of the trials of the assassins to see if that would make a good book. And it probably would have, but, you know, comics take a long time to do. They can take years, so you have to really think about how you're going to launch yourself. Are you still going to be interested 5 years down the road when you're still working on the same book?
Right.
And, you know, my life's kind of been full of journalistic work.
Mm-hmm.
So now it was a good time. I was at a pause good time to do the book.
Right. Now, how about the way you did the book, the accordion style drawing panorama? Was that part of his suggestion?
Yes. Matt was taken with a book by a artist named Matteo Pericoli called Manhattan Unfurled, which also is an accordion style book. It's quite beautiful, that shows the Manhattan skyline. But when Matt suggested the idea to me again, I didn't like the idea of doing a static image. And at first I was kind of going to say no.
Right.
Didn't sound that interesting. But then I thought, you know, I can do a narrative, because immediately I thought of the Bayeu Tapestry.
Mm-hmm. Now, and when have you seen the Bayeu Tapestry with your own
eyes? Not in real life. But
no.
I had this like National Geographic book on medieval times or something, and it actually has the full foldout of the Bayeu Tapestry.
Right. Now let's talk about what that is. What is the Bayeu Tapestry exactly?
The Bayeu Tapestry is about, it's over 200 some feet long, and it records the Norman invasion of England in 1066. And it starts, it was woven by a number of women, as far as I understand it, court women. And it starts on the left with King William.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes you through sort of some political machinations, and then they start building boats. You see them building boats, and then you move further along, and they're crossing the English Channel. And finally, there's the Battle of Hastings. So with that in mind, I thought, okay, it's possible to do a drawing that actually has a narrative. And being a cartoonist, I'm interested in narrative.
Mm-hmm.
It has a narrative. It takes you chronologically, and it takes you to another place in the same drawing.
Right, right. And as you slowly sort of, you could fold out the whole thing if you wanted to, if you had a 24-foot long floor or something, but you can also sort of page through it, and you get this kind of slow motion effect of movement as
right.
well.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So how about normally you work with a lot of words and you do a lot of reporting, and you usually put yourself in the frame. So this is the big departure for you in that way as well.
Yeah, but I've needed a creative break. I mean, that's another part of this whole equation. One of the reasons it did sound attractive is I wanted to sort of step away from journalism to some extent, or at least explore other things.
Yeah, right, right. So this is, right, this takes you away from that.
And also explore things in a different way, because I'm still interested in conflict, but if you're drawing something like this, you're thinking about it in a different way. With most of my journalism work, I meet people and I try to write about their lives, what they're saying, what they're thinking, how they're living. So I want to show how the average person is affected by historical events completely out of his or her control. That's what interests me, basically civilians in conflict. With this, because over the years, I've begun to sort of, you know, you spend 20 years doing this kind of journalism, and at some point you begin to wonder about humanity, let's put it that way. And it's not, I have questions in my head that I'm not sure journalism answers.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe philosophy answers, maybe neuroscience answers, maybe primatology answers.
Well, and when you say questions about humanity, you mean about people's good and evil, and those kind of what man does to man, kind of.
In some way, I mean, that's sort of it. Because what journalism helps explain is these people did this to those people, and for these reasons that you can sort of point to. But actually, when I was working on my book Footnotes in Gaza, which talks about the large-scale killing of Palestinians by Israeli forces in Gaza in 1956, you begin to wonder, because you realize, these are ordinary people killing ordinary people.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a hard time drawing the faces of the soldiers who are doing the killing. And the reason I realized afterwards is because if you don't know what someone's thinking, you have a very hard time drawing their face. You know, what facial expression am I going to draw on this person that's going to give me a hint of what he's thinking? I really couldn't come up with it.
And that's specifically when you're thinking about the people who committed those atrocities in 1956, say.
Yeah, but I mean, it doesn't matter. It's not even a question of who's killing whom. It's the fact that one group is killing another group. It happens all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's usually people who are normal, they have families, they love their children, and suddenly they're in this position where they have a gun and they're facing someone, and someone says they have to shoot them. And this is what sort of loses me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just made me think. It's made me want to explore other things. And doing this, I realized this would help me sort of take a step back. I mean, if you look at it, it's more disinterested than most of my work.
Mm-hmm.
It's as if you are hovering above a scene and just watching what's going on, and that's why there's no words.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, in one way, there's no need for words. In another way, I didn't want to have words interfere with just the sheer strangeness of the scene,
mm-hmm.
seen from a distance if you didn't know what it was all about.
Right. Right, you're at a remove from it.
There's a remove.
Yeah, yeah. It's like you're looking at it from a dirigible or something
right
there. Yeah.
But, you know, the great thing about drawing is it's a great luxury to draw because you think about the things you're drawing. So when I was drawing the soldiers walking up to the front, you know, most of the soldiers who went over the top at the Battle of the Somme, most of them were volunteers. Lord Kitchener had raised a volunteer army because he realized the war was going to go on. It wasn't going to be over by Christmas, so he knew enough to know that you needed a lot of people at the front. And people volunteered in huge numbers in these PALS units where you joined up with your friends.
So PALS, that's literally what that means?
They were called PALS battalions. They were literally your pals.
Right. It's like joining a fraternity or something, only go to war together.
Well, and actually people joined up also in battalions that were sort of, the nucleus was a professional class like clerks, or there was an artist's battalion. So that's where we would have been, Charles. The cartoonist battalion.
Well, what did the artist battalion do?
I don't know the specifics of what happened to the artist battalion, but then, you know, really what happens is they just sort of have a nucleus and then others are joining that aren't artists or aren't as good artists.
Right.
And, you know, that's sort of how it works.
So you guys would have been the first two, probably. Right.
But, you know, these people were enthusiastic. One thing you have to remember about World War One, I mean, is there was a great enthusiasm in the general population of the war, in general populations in the war, which is kind of startling to think, especially how it all played out, because after the war, you know, people were very despondent because
right
of what had happened.
Right. We were talking about it's different between World War One sort of creates all this alienation in a way, post-war, that's
right
very different than World War Two.
No, that's really right. But I wanted to show that enthusiasm to remind myself. When you're drawing it, you're thinking about those people. Like, why is this guy I'm drawing now, why is he enthusiastic? Like, what does he expect to happen here?
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. I mean, that enthusiasm met very hard reality. Not just at the Battle of the Somme. There were battles in 1914 and 1915 that were great. There was a great loss of life. But the Somme might be the place, the first day on the Somme might be the place where it was finished.
Mm-hmm.
It would be very hard for the average soldier to sort of think, okay, we're just going to walk into these German lines. They'll be so bombarded that we'll win the war and I can go home and tell my grandchildren in a few years.
Right. The day begins with great optimism and
right
meets harsh reality, like
very harsh
right
reality
away.
Right.
Yeah.
And of course, there were harsh realities in World War II, of course. People suffered greatly. The Allies suffered greatly. But I think at the end of World War II, I think people came away with a different taste. You
mm-hmm
know?
Right. There's the sense that evil had been pure, ultimate evil has been
yeah
vanquished, sort of.
I think so. I mean, I think people had, people sort of could size Hitler up and know what he was about. But I think when the camps were liberated, the death camps and the concentration camps, I think it was very clear what kind of world awaited us had Hitler won.
Mm-hmm.
So I think after World War II, no matter what you experienced and no matter what trauma you faced, at least there was that feeling, I think, that, okay, something in general has really been vanquished. Whereas in World War I, people came back home, and what could they say about what had happened? It's still not clear why. I mean, there are books coming out now about the origins of World War I because it's still not clear. It's still argued about constantly. It's constantly gone over. But what interests me isn't just the folly of the generals and the politicians, it's the folly of the populace.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why it's interesting to draw those soldiers and think about it.
Right, right. The populace sort of getting on board with,
yeah,
with the task at hand. Yeah, yeah. Well, let's look at some of what we've got up here, and if you could describe sort of...
This would be in the British trenches as the day is progressing and German artillery is raining down on British trenches, which were full of troops who hadn't gone over the top. Many British soldiers were killed before they left the trenches in this battle. Total number of casualties on the first day of the Somme was, for the British, was 57,000. These would be stretcher bearers trying to get wounded back while other troops are sort of pressing to get forward. And on the right, you'll see a stretcher bearer. The trenches were so crowded, it was just easier in some cases for stretcher bearers to leave the trench and to walk over exposed ground to get people back to medical attention quickly. That's just showing, on the right, it's showing the end of the trenches and, just a general scene.
Right.
But I mentioned 57,000 casualties, of which 21,000 were fatalities. And it's been most of the casualties apparently occurred in the first hour. And so the estimates are about at least 10,000 British soldiers were killed in the first hour. And just to put that into perspective, that's more than all the American servicemen killed in Iraq and Afghanistan combined.
Wow. Wow.
So, I mean, you can understand why this battle still has a great effect on the British consciousness. I mean, if you go to Britain, you talk about the Somme, they don't need anyone to explain what it was about.
Right.
It really matters in their history.
Right. It's sort of like physically... It reminds you of like the invasion of Normandy or something, where people are getting off boats and are exposed. But in the Somme, everybody's down in the trenches and sort of standing up and rushing into the oncoming fire.
Well, I think they began rushing once they saw what was happening. But initially, it was because I mentioned it was a volunteer army. The British High Command didn't have much faith in some of these troops that were seeing action for the first time. So in most cases, the troops were told... they were lined up Napoleonic style, just in a row, and then they were told to walk toward the German lines. Many of them were told that there'd be no German left alive after this preliminary bombardment.
Right, because there'd been so much artillery shelling before.
It was an unprecedented bombardment that went on for 7 days. But the Germans were relatively defensive-minded at this point, and they dug very deep dugouts. I mean, you can fault the British for a lot of things in World War I, and one of them was they never wanted their soldiers to have a defensive mindset, so they were never allowed to dig very deep dugouts. They wanted the soldiers basically to be uncomfortable in the trenches, so they're always thinking, okay, we need the offensive spirit because we want to get out of this place.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. There were dugouts for officers and NCOs, and most soldiers, if they had a place, they usually just sort of... dug a little hole in the side of the trench.
And you did, in order to learn all these details and to learn about how people got their meals served and all these things, you did a lot of research. There was a lot of stuff that you knew from years and years of osmosis, but also you did some additional research.
Yeah. I went to the Imperial War Museum in London to get small details, things that, you know, I have a lot of photo books of World War I, but they often show the same photos over and over again. But at the photo archive at the Imperial War Museum, you can get really good images of all kinds of things you never even would have imagined, including, I mean, just the names on the binders gave me a clue about what to put in there. There'd be a whole binder on mules. And you open that up and you realize, boy, mules are really, you know, they brought up mortar rounds and all this sort of stuff. Or carrying parties, you know, how do they bring up their stew or their breakfast? How do they bring up the barbed wire on their backs? That's the stuff you don't normally see in the average World War I book, but the photo archive at the War Museum in London is really good for that.
One of the things that's stunning about the book is you see how many horses there are and how it was an equine-powered war.
Well, yeah. I mean, the average British division in World War I would have had about 19,000 soldiers, about 60 motorized vehicles and 5,000 horses. So, you know, when I started this, I thought, oh, no, I have to draw horses. I'm not that good at it.
Yeah. So let's step back for a minute and talk about the – I mean, obviously, this is very serious stuff, and you've done a lot of very serious journalism over the years. And there are some people who work in that realm, but not that many. And where did you initially get the confidence and think – okay, I want to do war journalism, or I want to do tell stories that really talk about the big issues in society, and I can do that in comics. Where did that come from?
I never thought it through. I mean, basically, you know, like a lot of cartoonists, I was doing or thinking about doing autobiographical comics. Back in the 80s, you know, a lot of cartoonists were doing autobiographical comics. But I'd studied journalism in university and...
In Oregon, right?
At University of Oregon. And I was kind of one of those people who got out of school and had journalism jobs, but they just weren't satisfying in the least bit.
So you worked at newspapers? What did you do?
I worked at the National Notary Association writing articles about notarial products.
Mm-hmm.
And then I worked at a city magazine where I wrote a business column, not knowing a thing about business. But what was good is I had a photograph on top of the column, and my picture was like this. but in that particular place, I remember the ad salesman. They would sell an ad to a business, then they'd come to my desk and drop the business card on it and say, "That guy bought an ad. You probably want to write an article about his business."
Nice.
And you know, I didn't get into journalism for that.
Right.
So I eventually sort of stepped out of it.
Were you working on comics at the same time?
I was always working on comics, but I had no concept of how they get published or where it's published, and I never really thought they would be published.
Mm-hmm.
But at some point, I decided I was going to, you know, maybe I can make a living doing this. I began to find out about publishers like Fantagraphics, for mm-hmm. example. Then I started doing, you know, funny satirical comics, or what I consider funny comics. But I was still very interested in the world. I mean, that's why I got into journalism. And I was particularly interested in the Middle East and what was going on in the Palestinian territories. And I thought, well, I'll go there and I'll write a story of my experiences, again, coming out of the autobiographical tradition, and, you know, about my experiences in the occupied territories.
Mm-hmm.
But when I got there, I was much more journalistic about my approach, because obviously that had all sunk in. So instead of just talking to people, I was interviewing them,
right,
trying to get the quotes right, all that sort of stuff. And then I'm looking at all facets of the occupation. You begin to realize, okay, I've looked at this and this, but I should talk to someone who's had his home demolished. I should speak to someone who's had their olive trees cut down. You begin to think like a journalist, just because it was already in my blood.
Mm-hmm.
So there was never a theory of comics journalism. It sort of developed very organically.
Right.
And it only becomes a theory because you end up having to answer questions about it in a way. And then later on you're doing it and you realize what you're doing a little more. You're more self-conscious of it. But at the start I wasn't that self-conscious of what I was doing.
Did you did it obviously make natural sense to you to put yourself in the...
I was doing autobiography. I mean, again, that comes out
right,
very organically because... I was doing autobiographical comics, so they were always going to be my experiences. Then when they became more journalistic, I was quite glad I was in the comic because I realized that's the tip-off to the reader that this is a subjective work. Mm-hmm. You're seeing things through my eyes.
Right.
And also it allows me to tell the most interesting stories, which are the ones that happen to you negotiating a place as a foreigner.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause often, you know, when you talk to journalists, they'll tell you their amazing stories, and then you'll say, well, why isn't that in your article? And they'll say, well, because it involves me, and you can't sort of put yourself in. I mean, I know what they're going to answer.
Right.
But the stories I want to hear are the stories that you tell over a dinner table.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
those are the ones I'd...
And those are actually... Those dinner tables or those tables in bars might actually be in the book, like in Safe Area Garage.
Yeah, they might be like in the book, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. So you're... The comic that's in Notes from a Defeatist about your parents in Malta,
Yeah, the story of my mother's experiences in World War II.
Yeah. And you were actually born in Malta before you moved
to... I was born in Malta, yeah.
Yeah. Did those predate Palestine?
Yes. That when I was doing this comic series called Yahoo, which there was no one character. I was doing some autobiography, sort of some historical things. And in this case, I traveled with a rock band and did a story of going on tour as a roadie. And in this case, I had my mother write me letters about her experiences in World War II in Malta, which was very heavily bombed by the Germans and the Italians. And I just put those into comics form. But it was a good learning thing for me because, like, how do you draw someone else's story?
Mm-hmm.
And I realized right away, well, you have to ask a lot of visual questions. And actually, if I have artistic ability, I got it from my mom. So I'd say, so tell me how, draw me that, you said you used to grind coffee during the war. Can you draw that grinder? And so she would draw me things, uh-huh. like, draw me the shelter.
Right.
And I would sort of take her drawings and sort of, you know, use those as a basis.
But you had her write you letters. You didn't interview her.
I didn't interview her, no. I probably couldn't afford the phone bill in those days.
Oh, really? Because you were here and she was in Australia.
I was in Portland. No. She was living in California.
Okay.
My parents are still alive and they're living in California. So I was just I would basically tell her. I would maybe call her up or write her a letter and say, write me about living in the shelter. Write me about the time your friend was killed. Mm-hmm. Write me about the time the plane strafed you. You know, that sort of thing.
Right. Right. And those issues of your own parents in peril really then in some ways set the course for a lot of your own work later on about various populations in peril.
Well, it made me interested in civilians in conflict, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because my dad also had very similar stories to my mom. And in Australia was full in the 1960s when I was growing up of European migrants. Many, many Europeans left Europe, you know, war-torn Europe, after the war, up till about 65. For about 20 years, Australia was accepting migrants and paying for their passage to come.
Mm-hmm.
So our neighborhood, where I lived, was full of Europeans, and those were the family friends, so there'd be someone over from Holland, you know, and they would be talking about Holland in the war.
Right.
There were Germans there who would talk about Germany in the war. There was a Ukrainian. You know, you just heard all these stories, and you know, when you're a boy, you're just listening to this stuff, and it's kind of amazing.
Right.
But it definitely sort of put me on that path to think that, well, war is something that can actually be part of your life.
And you are also getting this sort of multiplicity of perspectives,
right.
I guess.
Right. Right. I mean, as a boy, you know, there's only so much you can sort of understand
sure.
as a boy. But yeah, it sort of paved the path in a way.
Right. And in the autobiographical comic tradition, were Crum and Harvey Pekar important to you early on, or?
Yeah, Harvey Pekar. I remember American Splendor and seeing that, and I couldn't believe that someone would write about his own little small life, but in such a way that made everything really interesting and beautiful somehow. Sort of the beauty of ordinary life and the frustrations of it. I mean, it was his best work is really still amazing.
Yeah.
Crumb's work to some extent. But then, you know, other cartoonists around you, like Chester Brown's work or,
mm-hmm.
you know, some of those people. A lot of cartoonists were doing that sort of thing.
Right, right. And you actually, I mean, this American Splendor here actually includes a Joe Sacco story.
Oh, yeah. I did a lot of work with Harvey at a certain point. He saved my ass financially. Because when I was working on the Palestine book, I was making no money at all at the comic book
mm-hmm.
When it came out as a series of comics. And once he called up and he said, Joe, it's Harvey Pekar. And I thought it was a friend fooling with me. And he convinced me it was him. And then he asked me to do some work with him
right.
eventually. So
so he was commanding some money. At
and
least
he was then. Always he was always very good about giving me half the money. He'd call up, Joe, I thought of another way we could make some bread.
Really?
But it was great because, you know, I bet he was one of the only authentically working class artists working, you know.
Really, right, he worked in the hospital
he
all
worked,
those
yeah,
years. Yeah,
yeah. And he was always very diligent about making sure you got paid and that whole thing, so.
Right, right. Okay, I think it's time now to take some questions. If anybody has questions, and if anybody who does have a question could say it into a microphone, that'd be great. I guess we should point on somebody. Here we go. That's you. Yeah.
Yes. Those kind of interesting. You know, the what you mentioned earlier about how more people were killed in the first day than there were in Iraq and Afghanistan combined. But one of the differences, of course, nobody had the television cameras up there and bringing it live into the living room. I'm just curious, when you're talking about the people and how the Europeans were reacting at the time, do you have any thoughts about how they might have reacted had they had the television bringing it into their living room in, you know, the early 20th century as we did in Iraq and Iran?
Well, maybe in some cases, the television wasn't necessary because if you've seen the film Paths of Glory by Stanley Kubrick, it's based on a true incident that took place the next year when many units of the French army mutinied and refused to go into the trenches. So it wasn't really a matter of bringing it home to the populations. It was brought home in a lot of ways because there was the blockade of Germany where people were starving. And many died of starvation, and the blockade continued after the war. But in the case of the mutiny of the French, if they did go into the trenches, many of them would bleat like sheep. So people started to know what was going on, and they were very self-reflective about what was about to happen to them. And the French army ended up shooting a number of people, a number of soldiers, to make examples. And of course, we all know what happened in Russia. The Russian army faded away during the revolution. You know, some of those troops were going into combat without rifles and or without boots in the winter. And there's only so far you can push people. So it's true, you know, like at the Imperial War Museum, there are no real photographs, I'd say, of combat. There's photographs of shells exploding, but of going over the top. There's some famous footage of people going over the top, which is considered faked. It might be show something, you know, give you an idea, but it's faked. So, like, even drawing those particular scenes, what I had to rely on was prose, like first-person accounts, and that's how I got some of those images. But you're right. If people see the gory details of war, maybe they think it twice, but do we really see the gory details of war today? What we see is a truck going by and then the screen, there's a flash, and then there's a big black cloud as we get an idea of what this laser-guided precision bomb did. Those are the majority of images of war like that.
How about right here?
Obviously, your years and years of study and reflection have gone into producing this particular volume. But I would imagine for many, many, many Americans, they're coming to your volume with virtually no knowledge or understanding of World War I, period. And so since there is no accompanying narrative, even as you were drawing it, you must have been aware that people would be coming, seeing the images, but not knowing the story. So as you were drawing, walk me through the story as you would want me to understand it if I'm coming to the pictures with no knowledge whatsoever.
Walk you through it?
Not the whole thing, but how do you want me to respond?
Okay.
As a first-time viewer,
right,
not knowing anything about the actual history.
Okay, I'll try to answer your question, but let me point out that actually the package it comes with a booklet. It does,
yeah.
With a great essay by Adam Hochschild, who's kind of my favorite historian. He wrote a book, To End All Wars, and it's adapted from that. But it gives the reader the context. There is,
right.
And I also do. The image is reprinted in small size, and there are annotations where I explain some of the things, not editorializing, just facts of what's going on. Basically, the story starts with General Haig, the architect of the Battle of the Somme, at his chateau, and then it takes you all the way to the grave. So it's everything between the general and the grave, which means the build up. It means the artillery bombardment. It means the battle itself where they go over the top. And it means the wounded coming back and to the casualty clearing stations at the end. Okay. There's that gentleman over there that has his hand up and has something to say.
Thank you. This is very interesting. In many ways, World War I was the end of an era, particularly the era of the British Empire. And I saw one of your drawings, which seemed to express that very dramatically, which was of East Indian cavalry with lances. Is that accurate?
Yeah, it's completely accurate. One of the interesting things about General Douglas Haig, who planned the battle, was after the bombardment, after the infantry took the German trenches, his plan was for the cavalry to ride through the gap in the German lines and to break the stalemate of trench warfare. He was a cavalryman. He came out of the cavalry, and every day, as I show it, and I think it's the next illustration. It might be two illustrations from now. He would take a ride escorted by the Lancers. I don't think the Lance was withdrawn from British Army until the 20s. But there was an Indian cavalry regiment and two other regiments waiting behind the lines to go through the gap that never appeared. Even after the war, Haig said, and I'm trying to quote it accurately, the airplane and the tank are just additions to the man and the horse. The thing about General Haig is he's been vilified by historians and rehabilitated by some historians too. You can take your pick of what viewpoint to have of him, but I have a very low opinion of General Haig.
Right here.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm a huge fan of your work, and I have a question regarding one of my favorite graphic novels ever, Palestine. If you could tell us what was the most unforgettable / powerful experience you had working on this book, particular book.
You know, it's in some ways it's hard to say what. It was the first time I ever did anything like that, going to a place like that. So almost every experience, every day, was something I'd never seen before in my life. And I was talking to some amazing people and seeing amazing things and seeing horrible things. And it's such a swirl of interesting things. I mean, I'll just bring out one incident. I don't think it's necessarily the one that sticks out the most, but it's the one, it had a lot of power, I'm just remembering it right now, is talking to a man who, when I visited him, you know, his olive trees were cut down. And I went to talk to him, and he told me that the soldiers made him cut down the trees himself. And some of these trees are really old, and it's the livelihood of people. So I remember him saying, when I cut down the trees, I felt like I was killing my son. You know, that stuck in my head. But there are many other things, of course. Sure.
Over here.
Oh, thank you. I like two things I like to say. I'm saying when I was growing up, right, I lived in the neighborhood. I was born and raised in North Philadelphia, right? And so it was guys in my neighborhood that they was African-Americans and they had served in the First World War. But I'm saying as kids, man, we used to, because they lied to them when they were like drunks and whatever, like that tough stuff. But for the most part, later on I found out that they was telling the truth, because it was a book, Temple University Press, called The African-American Soldier During World War I. And then this guy, Mr. Mack, used to tell me the story, the unit he was in, he actually fought in combat. But most of the African-American guys that used to live in my neighborhood during the First World War, they had mixed emotions in the sense that, like, they were saying that they enjoyed it or they loved it because that was the first time they ever made love to white women.
Well, I don't have to add to that, I think. Thanks for the anecdote. There was one African American I think who flew for the French.
Bullard,
that's right. Yeah, he flew for the. It wasn't the Lafayette Escadrille. It was another squadron, I think.
Right here.
Yeah, I've always loved your drawings.
Oh, thank you.
And you haven't really talked much about your evolution of your drawing skills, and I'm just totally blown away. I'm like, how?
That's kind of you to say.
No, not really. I mean, you're above the scene. Nothing would have been above the scene. So this is your imagination for the whole thing. So you're internalizing these photographs, and you're in the moment, imagining it comprehensively. I'm pretty amazed. I mean, is this? Did you draw just like right out of the womb or nonstop?
I'll have to ask my mom. I've never thought of myself as a naturally good artist. I think I'm relatively good at composition. I'll say that. But it's taken a long time to sort of feel like I know what I'm doing. And what I had in my favor when I was younger and drawing was that I wasn't critical of my own work. If I had been self-critical, I might have stopped drawing. Because I see what a lot of other people do as far as the facility they have with the pen at a very young age. And if I certainly didn't have that, when I see what they have compared to what I had at that time, it would have been very intimidating. But I always sort of have confidence in, oh, that's really pretty good. Then 2 years later, I'm going, oh my God, I can't believe that passed. But you know, you just get better with working on it. But thank you.
Let's see, towards the back here, over here. Maybe. Yeah.
Thank you. I know the battle went from July to November, the entire campaign of the Somme. Do you cover every month with that, or is it just usually the first day?
It's just the first day. I mean, I thought that was a self-contained episode. It's well known what happened on the first day. But yes, you're right. The battle went on for about 4.5 more months, and the British gained at the most, in some parts of the front, 12 kilometers, and more than 1 million casualties on all sides.
Here.
You're a very good audience. A lot of questions.
Thank you. Is there some way that you could give us an idea of the decisions you make? If you consider just one panel and you think, what do I want to put in that, and what are my sources, and how I have to imagine every little detail? I mean, like, you know, somebody being shot or somebody being carried away on a stretcher. I mean, is there kind of a process you go through when you decide on what you put in each panel?
Well, at first, I don't normally do this, but I'm glad I did. And I did it because my editor, Matt Weiland, asked me to do it so he could help sell the idea to other editors. He asked me to sort of figure out, like, what I would show basically in each page, a rough idea. So that helped me draw a rough outline. I knew, okay, you know, 5 pages for the build-up, 3 or 4 pages for the artillery bombardment, you know, a few pages for over the top. It gave me a sense of the rhythm, and I needed that before I started. I collected all my information in Britain, all those photographs. I had hundreds of photocopies of these photographs filed away kind of at my feet so I could get them easily. And I just sort of started drawing. And one of the things I wouldn't recommend to other cartoonists, but this is how I do my work. I don't rough things out. I normally draw directly onto the page, which means I'm almost immediately erasing what I've just drawn because I don't get it right. But I sort of go back and forth with this sort of process of making mistakes and letting myself make mistakes and even figuring things out, like even the angle that I think this woman here mentioned. I wasn't really sure. I had to sort of get it right, and then finally I sort of settle on it. And then I'm if I'm drawing a horse, I'm thinking, okay, I need to draw that bridle on that horse, and I try to look up something about the bridle. What does the stirrup look like? I mean, all these little details you're trying to do as you go along. But the advantage I find in not roughing things out is when I'm drawing the person on the horse, he has a spontaneous character in my mind. I mean, I have to think about his body type, whether he's smoking a pipe, if he's talking to someone, all that sort of stuff. So there's a spontaneous element that goes on also. Most of the planning is in the research stage, and I try to keep drawing, in all cases, throughout all my work, as spontaneous as possible.
I'm right here.
Good evening, sir. My question about telling the truth and making living telling the truth. You make living telling us and teaching us the truth. Two examples. For example, if we Winston Churchill, for example, if you compare his quote from World War I to his quote and opinion from World War II, it will make our head, my head spin. The Palestinian-Israeli conflict, if you really watch them closely from 48 until now, practically an example for them is like two people who like to have sex, but they don't want it to get married, and they want other people to take care of their children. So when you see those, do you have problem, you know, telling the truth and making a living doing it?
Oh, do I have a problem telling the truth? And
taking those two examples, you know, what we know about World War I and World War II, and what we really know about the Palestinian-Israeli conflict,
well,
in the span of the last 50 years.
I'm not entirely sure I understand the question, but obviously a lot that happened in World War I, a lot that's going on in the Middle East now is related to the First World War and how the Middle East was divided up. I mean, if you speak to a Palestinian, an older Palestinian, they often know things that, you know, most Americans don't know. I remember meeting an old man in, I think it was Jenin, and he was talking about the Sykes-Picot Agreement, which is when the French and the British secretly divided up the Ottoman Empire before World War I ended. They made divisions. And it was a secret agreement that when the Russians had some hand in, and when the Russian Revolution happened, the Bolsheviks released all those. It was like Snowden. They just released all these documents for people to see. And I remember him saying, America is the snake, because as far as he was concerned, America was supporting policies of Israel that obviously he didn't agree with. But he said Britain is the head of the snake, because a lot came out of Britain. And a lot was decided in the early 20s by people like Churchill, by a number of T.E. Lawrence. There were a number of people who decided these things. And we still live, or people live, on the consequences of some of those decisions.
Since you have the mean to educate the people about how things are, for example, the young lady was asking you, she was so excited about your exposing of the Palestinian conflict and showing things how the Palestinians are victimized and things like that. But actually, if you look a little bit deeper in the conflict, you could dig a little bit deeper and use your stage in actually
exposing it. I could always look a bit deeper. I mean, that's clear to me. I try to in my book Footnotes in Gaza, which gets into some, I think it gets into some depth. But I'm more interested, I think what I can do most effectively is write about, with the context and explaining some of the history, bringing to light what's going on today with people who I'm meeting, because I have a real relationship with those people. So, you know, honestly, I just do the best I can. That's kind of my best answer for you.
It's over here. To your left.
Hi. I was just wondering, after seeing and inhaling so much of war,
What you said that you had questions about humanity. I was just wondering, what were those questions, and what are your theories on why?
Well, I mean, it's the why I'm interested in, and part of why I want to step away from journalism is, on some level, I feel like I'm starting to not repeat myself, but I'm seeing the same things over and over again. And you can always explain the particulars of a specific situation. But if you keep seeing a situation here similar to a situation over here, you begin to wonder about the commonalities. And actually, I don't think right now I have answers for that, why as a species we behave the way we do. But I'm on the case, let's put it that way. I'm thinking about it. And I'm reading what I can in a lot of sort of disciplines, and hopefully I'll talk to people who will know a lot more than I do about these sorts of things. But it really intrigues me. It really intrigues me. And so I do want to do some other work that explores, you know, how we got to where we are. And that's why, I mean, I was talking backstage about a project I want to do about ancient Mesopotamia. Because I'm interested in how did social hierarchy develop? How did political hierarchy develop? How did the central state develop? And how did the state get people to do things in those days, like dig the canals? Obviously for everyone's benefit, or was it for everyone's benefit? You know, it's like, those are questions I have now, is sort of to go back as far as I can to sort of see if I can come up with answers. I might be totally unsuccessful, but we'll see.
Going on the way, way back machine there.
The way, way back machine.
Yeah. Have it right over here.
Hello.
Hi.
Graphic pictures. One of the best military historians, current military historians, is John Keegan. And he wrote an incredible account of the Battle of the Somme in his book, The Face of Battle. I'm wondering if you read it and if you got images from his words, because he's quite graphic in how he describes the battle itself. And lastly, I just wanted to answer that man back there that no news came out of the war. As soon as the war happened, the propaganda machine took over, and you did not get an idea of what was happening in the war, especially British and French censorship.
You know, regrettably, I haven't read Keegan's book. I know I should have. It's well known, and I probably should have read it. But I think I've read enough now. I mean, there were a string of books about the Somme in particular that I read that were very specifically about the Somme. And those are the ones I concentrated on. Also, there's some good fiction about World War I. And I know there's some current fiction that's supposed to be very good, or recent fiction. But one of the books that's always stuck out in my mind was Her Privates We by Frederick Manning, which was written, I think, in the late 20s or 30s. It's really a good book. But, you know, it's like the power of prose is that it gives you images in your head. And so it's just a question of taking some of those prose images in your head and sort of letting them go through your hand onto the page. I mean, it's just converting the images you see in your head.
Is it me?
Hi. I was derelict in my introduction, not to mention Dan DeLuca was our interviewer from the Inquirer.
Here I am.
Can you believe it?
But the question I have is... as an artist, is how did you draw it? I mean, you say they're pages, but they're continuous and there's no line at the end. So how big did you draw, and how did you get them to all fit together? And then my second question is, how'd you decide how to do the explosives?
Well, the explosions are sort of stylized on some level, but I actually had a file on shell bursts, because there are pictures in the Imperial War Museum of the barrage on the German trenches at the Battle of the Somme, then shell bursts in general, and then shell bursts at gunnery ranges. So that gave me an idea of how shells, how earth flies up. But I sort of compressed them. It's a bit more stylized, the way I've drawn them. And the first part, basically 12 sheets of board. So there were two pages, let's say, on each board. I was drawing on a piece that was about a yard long. And I realized that I don't know how to use Photoshop. So what I did is I would write to the production people, and I would photocopy one board and one the end of one board and the end of the other, and I would just take that photocopy and I would sort of show how it one should lay over the other, because sometimes one sheet laid over this, you know, one thing laid over from this page on this sheet, and sometimes vice versa. So I would say this tree goes over that farmhouse, and it became clear that you can actually do that, and they were very good about those instructions. So it looks seamless. It looks more seamless than it might have if I, you know, if we didn't work well, if I didn't work well with the production people. Like everything, it's under my desk, piling up, waiting for a fire. He said horribly.
All right, we got one more question. Let's go right here.
Actually, your comment follows up right to my question. What is your drawing space look? What does it look like?
It's in my house. It's like a converted bedroom. I have about three tables, flat tables, a lot of books everywhere. It's a mess. Normally what I do is I clear off a whole table because I think I'm going to be very organized, but I always end up drawing in a very small little area about this size with things laying on top of each other all over the place. So it's a bit messy, and after each project I go through and I clean up and I promise myself I'll be better organized than I never am. But you know, you stop trying to fight who you are if you're an artist, I think, and just sort of go with it. So that's that.
All right. Thanks very much, everybody. You guys are a great audience.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.